Misconduct is a bi-weekly podcast that looks into lesser-known crimes, cold cases, wrongful convictions, and miscarriages of justice. Join Colleen as she takes a deep dive straight into the facts and theories of a new case each episode, discussing stories that didn't always get the coverage that they deserved. You'll find episodes that will take you through why Oakland, California's oldest cold case is still on the books, or how a botched investigation let the murderer of a 12-year-old girl walk free. Misconduct is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or your favorite podcasting app. Make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. This is a case about murderous rage and anger. Assistant State's Attorney Arthur Jackman began his opening statement at the Sarasota County Courthouse in Sarasota, Florida. It was March 15, 2013, and the stakes were high. If Jackman succeeded in convincing the jury of his case, then the defendant, 48-year-old John Lee, would be facing the death penalty. But just 1 year prior, the same case had ended in a mistrial during jury selection, after a judge ruled that potential jurors had discussed the case amongst themselves. In January 2011, after being released from jail on a domestic violence and battery charge, John Lee was told that as a condition of his release, he was to have no contact with his alleged victims, his girlfriend, 39-year-old Tracy Nabergall, or their neighbor, 46-year-old Jason Salter. But just 2 days later, both Tracy and Jason would be found dead in Jason's home, both having suffered multiple stab wounds. And within 24 hours, John Lee would be arrested and charged in their murders. Today, more so than ever, I'm going to let the trial tell the story. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 69. In his opening statements, Jackman told the jury that John Lee and Tracy Nabergall lived together in a home on Park Road in Venice, Florida. Jason was their neighbor, who lived down the block on the same road. Tracy and Jason had started spending time together, something that John didn't like. On January 19, 2011, John was arrested for battering both Tracy and Jason. He was released just days later, but the judge ordered that he was not only to have no contact with either of them, but he was not to return to Jason's house either. Days later, both were found dead. Jackman told the jury that part of the evidence they will be presenting involves phone records. They will learn that after John was released from jail, he made numerous phone calls and text messages to Tracy's phone. The last call was made at 7:34 p.m. on January 24th, less than a half hour before the bodies were found.
The defendant doesn't make any further phone calls to Tracy's cell phone because he knows she's dead.
John was arrested at his friend Rhonda's home the next day, on January 25th. He was immediately a suspect after his prior arrest for battering the victims. On the morning of January 26th, a search warrant was executed at Rhonda's house where John was arrested. His cell phone and charger were on a table in the bedroom. Jackman said the clothing that John had been wearing when he committed the murders was recovered by police, and that clothing matched the same clothing he was seen wearing on surveillance video from earlier in the day, as he was leaving a pretrial services meeting at the courthouse. Investigators also recovered the murder weapon after John's friend told them where he had put it after the murders. Jackman told the jury that they would be hearing from the medical examiner who performed the autopsies. They would hear that Tracy's throat was slashed severely and she was stabbed in the chest. Jason also suffered severe knife injuries. Jackman said the evidence will show that John had a motive of jealousy, something he even communicated to the pretrial services officer he met with that day. He asked the jury to find John Lee guilty of first-degree murder. In their opening statements, one of John's attorneys, Jerome Meisner, told the jury that John and Tracy had a tumultuous relationship. At the heart of the problem, he said, was Tracy's drug use, which John didn't like. The couple had recently moved into their home on Park Road in Venice, and unfortunately, the location was not a good one for someone trying to get off drugs.
You will hear that Tracy became acquainted with a man named Jason Salter, who lived several houses down. And the evidence will show that Jason Salter was providing drugs to Tracy Navrigal. The evidence will show that John Lee was trying to prevent her from having contact with him.
On January 24th, John was making efforts to keep Tracy away from Jason's house, but he failed. Meisner told the jury that they would hear testimony from witnesses who claimed to have seen these interactions between the two, and that it's up to them to evaluate their credibility. Meisner admitted that on January 24th, in the early evening, John did go to Jason's house, where a physical confrontation occurred inside, he said. It started in the living room and then was carried into the southeast bedroom. It was in the southeast bedroom, he said, where Jason met his end. Tracy's body was found on a couch in the living room. He said they will hear testimony about John's activity after he left the scene on January 24th. One of the witnesses, Rhonda Porter, is a very heavy drinker who suffers from blackouts and memory lapses. When you hear all the evidence from everyone, he said, we will return and ask you for a verdict of not guilty of the murder of Tracy Navrigal and not guilty in the death of Jason Salter. The first witness for the state was Kenneth Marlin, Jason Salter's cousin and best friend. He said on January 24th, 2011, Jason called him and asked him to give him a ride somewhere. When he went to pick him up, he pulled his truck into Jason's driveway and beeped his horn quite a bit. He tried calling Jason's cell phone, but he didn't pick up. So Kenneth got out and walked up to the house. The front door was partially open, and he could hear the stereo blasting music. He walked inside and saw Tracy's body in a sitting position on the couch. He could see that her throat was cut from ear to ear. He was only in the house for about 2 or 3 seconds. He was shaken and scared and immediately walked out. He grabbed his cell phone and tried to dial 911, but he said he froze. He got into his truck and drove down to the gas station right down the street. He went inside and asked the guy working behind the counter to call 911, but he said the man wouldn't do it. Kenneth told the jury that he can't read or write, and sometimes it's difficult for him to make phone calls himself. He said he finally saw a fire truck headed down the street towards Jason's house. So he followed it, and the sheriff's department was there then. Someone else had called 911. That someone else was Jay Kovacevic, who testified next. Jay told the jury that Jason lived down the street from him, and they were friends. On January 24th, three friends of his, who also lived in the neighborhood, came over to his house, and then they walked down to Jason's house. He said the door was completely open and the stereo was blasting very, very loud. He walked into the living room. There were bloody footprints on the floor. He went over to the stereo and turned it off. He then turned from the stereo and looked at the other love seat in the room. He began crying on the stand as he recalled seeing a lady on the couch with her throat cut. He walked up to her and touched her arm. He wanted to see if she was still alive. As he got closer, he could see that her throat had been cut out. She was definitely not alive. He ran outside and called 911 from his friend's phone. Deputy Joshua Welch with the Venice Police Department was the first deputy on the scene. He said when he arrived, about 2 to 3 minutes after getting the call, a fire truck and an ambulance were parked on the street, and the yard was taped off with evidence tape. As he approached, two fire personnel greeted him and told him that they would show him the scene. The front door was wide open, and he noted that there was blood all over the inside of the door. Bloody footprints were on the floor, and on the sofa in the living room was a female, on her back, with a large laceration through her throat. He told the jury that the deputies didn't search the rest of the house at first because they thought that fire personnel had already been back there. But when they did check the back bedroom, they saw a large pool of blood and then saw Jason's body. Lisa Lanham, a crime scene investigator, testified that she took photographs of John Lee after his arrest. She noted that there was a cut on his hand, a cut on his finger, and some damage to his nail bed. Lanham also went to the crime scene and took photographs, and she noted that there were bloody footprints there, from the heel of a shoe with a design pattern. Daphne Smith was a friend of Jason Salter's. She said they grew up together and were lifelong friends. She only met Tracy once, on January 19, 2011, 5 days before the murders. It was Jason's birthday, and she had gone over to his house so she could drive him to the doctor and then back home.
When we arrived at the house, we just got inside the house, and a lady came up in the driveway knocking on the door. She was hysterical.
Describe her physical demeanor. Tell us a little bit about what she looked like. As far as, you use the word hysterical.
She was crying. She was hysterical. Couldn't really understand what she was saying at first. Brought her in the house and sit down.
Okay, let me stop you right there.
Okay.
You said you couldn't understand what she was really saying at first. Why was that?
And she was crying and sobbing.
She later learned that it was Tracy Nabergall. They brought her into Jason's house and were trying to comfort her, but Tracy was hysterical.
At first, it was hard to understand what she was saying because she was so upset and crying and stuff, and it took me a little while to get her calmed down. And she had said that she got beat up.
Okay. Did there come a time when she calmed down and you were able to understand what she was saying to you?
Yes.
Okay. Did you notice any injuries on Tracy?
Yes, she had marks on her neck, and she had scratches on her face, and she had it almost appeared to look like a older black eye.
All right. Can you show the jury, when you talk about the scratches on her face, can you show them with your hands where you saw the scratches?
Right on her cheeks and stuff.
All right. Did you see anything, did you see any other injuries in addition to the scratches on her cheeks?
Yeah, there were bruising around her neck.
Okay. Any other injuries besides the bruising around her neck and the scratches on her cheek?
Just the older-looking black eye that was, like, yellow. It looked like an older black eye.
Do you remember what Tracy was wearing that day?
She had a tank top on.
When you looked at her arms, were you able to see any visible injuries on her arms?
Yeah, the one arm looked like somebody had grabbed her on the arm, where you could see the finger marks.
And did those injuries appear to be fresh to you?
Yes.
Tracy told her that her boyfriend, John, had beat her up.
She said that he had beat her up a couple times, so this was not the first time. This was the second time around.
All right. Did she say anything about going back to her home?
She said she was scared. She didn't want to go back.
Right. And Mr. Salter was there throughout this entire conversation?
Yes, he was.
All right. Did Jason Salter appear to you to be concerned about Tracy being so upset?
Yes.
And how do you form that opinion? How do you know that?
Just knowing Jason. You know, he gave you his shirt off his back.
Okay.
He was concerned.
Right. What was Jason's reaction when Tracy showed up at his house in this manner, crying as she was?
He was upset too. He was wanting to know what was going on.
She said as they were comforting Tracy, there was a sudden banging on the windows and doors. She and Tracy looked outside, and Tracy told her that it was John. She could hear him shouting for Tracy to get her ass out there. John then walked around to the side of the house and banged on those windows, still hollering. Tracy became hysterical again and ran to the bathroom, saying that she wasn't going to go outside. She was afraid that John was going to come in. Daphne suggested that they call the police, but Tracy didn't want to because she said she didn't know what he would do to her. At that point, Daphne went outside.
Tell the jury, did you have a conversation with him?
Yes, I did.
And tell the jury what that conversation consisted of.
I asked him why he was beating on my windows and doors and what was going on.
And what did he respond?
He said he wanted Tracy outside right now.
Did he say anything else about Tracy?
I can't recall at that time, but the only thing that I was thinking was how I could calm him down.
Okay, well, before we talk about that, let's talk about how he looked. Can you please describe for us his physical demeanor?
He was pumped up. He was angry. His face was red. His ears were red. His eyes were just beaten.
Did he still continue to shout when you came outside?
Yeah, at first, yes.
Was he using profanity?
He was just telling her to get her ass out of the house.
She was about an arm's length away from him. John asked her who she was, and she lied and said she was Jason's girlfriend. That appeared to calm him down enough to where she could talk to him, and he wasn't steadily shouting for Tracy. She told him that Tracy was scared of him and that she wouldn't be going back to his house. John told her that she had no reason to be scared. She told him that he had beat her up, and he denied it. Tracy eventually came out of the house, and John told her to get her ass in the truck so they could go. Tracy was still nervous and upset. She told him that she wasn't going back to the house and told him that she was scared of him.
How many times did Tracy tell John Lee that she was afraid of him?
A few times.
More than once?
Yes.
More than twice?
Yeah. She just said she was scared of him. She wasn't going back to the house.
Okay. Did there come a time when you yourself told John Lee that you were going to call the police?
Yes.
And how did he react? What was his response then?
He was ready to leave then.
Okay.
Not happy. Not happy at all.
John got in his truck and peeled out. She said he was driving erratically. Daphne and Tracy talked for a little bit after John left. Tracy was still crying and was upset. She was new in town and didn't have anywhere to go. Tracy told her that she didn't know what she was going to do, but that she wasn't going back to her house. Daphne said she left about 15 to 20 minutes later, but later that night, she went back to Jason's house to celebrate his birthday. That was the last time she saw him. Sergeant Mark Tulls with the Sarasota Sheriff's Office testified about what happened later that night on January 19th. He said he responded to a call at Jason Salter's residence at 7:28 p.m. He spoke with Jason outside the home while Tracy spoke with another deputy. He said Tracy was crying and appeared to be upset. She had redness on the front and sides of her neck. When they finished talking to Jason and Tracy, they then went down the street to John and Tracy's house, where they arrested John for battery and domestic violence. Jason and Tracy were the victims. Deputy Daniel Hodge, the deputy who was with Sergeant Tulls that night, testified that Tracy told him that John had grabbed her by the throat and slammed her against the wall. He said she had red marks on her throat that appeared to be fresh. Nancy Williams, a pretrial services supervisor, testified that she met with John Lee at her office in the South County Courthouse shortly before the murders. She said pretrial services is the supervised release program, which enforces the conditions of release as ordered by the judge. Defendants typically report to them after they're released from jail, and her office will then explain the terms of their release. She said John posted an $11,500 bond and was released on January 22nd. On January 24th, he came into her office at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. She went over the conditions with him, including the order that he was not to return to Jason Salter's home, not to return to the home he shared with Tracy, and not to have any contact with the victims, whether directly or indirectly. He would be allowed to return to his home one time with law enforcement officers to retrieve any clothing and medications. Williams testified that there was a zero-tolerance policy to all of the conditions and that the court wanted to be notified immediately if he didn't comply. She explained the consequences to John if he were to have any contact with the victims. She told him that he would be arrested for violating the no-contact order. She described his demeanor during the meeting as agitated and emphatic that he needed to get back to his property in order to take care of Tracy.
Did the defendant make any statements with regard to Tracy Neighbordell and Jason Salter? And if you need to refresh your recollection by looking at your report, you may do so.
Okay. But I do remember him saying that he felt that Jason was trying to steal his girl. And he stated that if he tried to steal his girl, there would be further problems.
after Joan Lee made that statement about that there would be further problems if Jason Salter was speaking to his girl, did you take further steps to reinforce your conditions of pretrial release?
Yes, I felt it was a good opportunity to re-stress the no contact order, and I did so.
And why did you feel that it was necessary to reiterate those conditions?
He was emphatic about it. He kept going back to that statement, and it almost felt threatening, so I wanted to make sure he understood the consequences if he did go back.
She said John asked if the order could be modified, and so she helped him fill out a form so that he could request that the order be lifted. He wrote in the form that he was requesting to be allowed back to his house and wrote, "Tracy wants me there. She cannot take care of herself due to no job and seizures." But even though he wrote that in the form, he told Nancy something different.
Yes, when we were speaking, he told me that he needed to get back to that property because it was a bad neighborhood, and Tracy was fearful, and he was afraid that the neighbors were going to try to get her to use drugs.
But he did not write that explanation. He had a different explanation when he actually filled out this form.
Yes, I was not aware that she was unemployed and had seizures or had any medical problems. He never mentioned that in our conversation.
In her notes from their meeting, she wrote that he said, verbatim, "You better not ever catch that guy speaking to my girl again, or there will be problems." She also wrote in her notes about John's urgency to have the order lifted. She wrote, "He states it's urgent because his girlfriend is fearful of the bad neighborhood, and, quote, I need to be there to protect her." Williams testified that she did not contact Jason or Tracy after the meeting. She generally does contact the victims, but she didn't in this case. She said John left around 3:30, and she got busy with work. She decided she would contact them the next morning. But the next morning, she received a phone call from the state's attorney's office, and that's when she learned about the murders. Detective Timothy Speth pulled the surveillance video from the South County Courthouse and saw John in the building on his way to and then coming from his meeting with Nancy Williams. That surveillance video was played in court. At 3:23 p.m., John exits the elevator and walks towards the security checkpoint. He is wearing a blue shirt with white lettering and jeans. He then gets back on the elevator at 3:51 p.m. Kevin McElia, a lieutenant with the sheriff's office, testified that after he arrived at the scene, he was told that officers had had prior contact at Jason's residence a couple days before the murders. That prior contact had involved a man named John Lee, who lived down the street. He and a few other officers went to John's house, where they believed he was. They set up a perimeter around the house in order to make sure that no one went in and no one came out. After trying his landline, they then called John's cell phone number. John answered, and Lieutenant McElia identified himself and then asked him to come outside. John asked, "Come outside where?" McElia told him that they were outside of his residence on Park Road. He said they wanted to talk to him about a disturbance that had occurred. He testified that John told him that he wasn't allowed to be on that street, and then he continually asked about the disturbance McElia was calling about. "Who called it in, and why do you want to talk to me?" he kept asking. He then told McElia that he wasn't in the house, that he was in Bradenton with a friend. They spoke for a little more than 5 minutes. McElia asked him specifically where he was in Bradenton so he could have officers meet him there. John told him that he didn't want to talk to anyone and didn't have anything else to say. He then hung up the phone. McElia testified that they then contacted John's phone company, Metro PCS, and requested a location for John's cell phone. In their quest to apprehend John, Sergeant Christopher Montalbano testified that he was responsible for setting up a surveillance team in the town of Inglewood. They had received information that John was driving a 1991 blue Ford Econoline van and that he might be in the area. Sure enough, on January 25th, the day after the murders, they spotted the van at a residence in Inglewood. They learned that one of John's friends, a woman named Rhonda Porter, lived there with her husband and son. At one point, they sent Mr. Porter inside to tell John to come out, and he did. He was then taken into custody. A search warrant was executed on the property on January 26th, but they also went back to the property on January 27th. Sergeant Montalbano said that Rhonda, through her attorney, had requested that they come back. When they arrived, Rhonda was visibly shaken. She was crying and was very nervous and scared. She took them out to a wooded area in the rear of her property and pointed to a specific spot. Investigators began digging items out of a hole that had been dug into the backyard: a towel, a pair of running shoes, jeans, and a t-shirt. Sergeant Montalbano said that later on, they also began a search of all the sewers between the crime scene and Inglewood, and they found a knife in the storm sewers near the crime scene and John's house. A woman named Ashley Trimble testified that she and John's nephew, Keith, lived in an efficiency unit behind John and Tracy's house on Park Road. On January 12, 2011, she said she was in the laundry room doing hers and Keith's laundry when she heard a smack, followed by yelling. She recognized the voice as that of John Lee. The next morning, she saw Tracy and noticed injuries.
Will you please describe to the jury what you saw?
Crutches. She had a leg cast on her left arm. She had handprints. On her neck, she had bruises. And on her left eye, she had a bruise.
Okay. Did you have an opportunity to look closely at her injuries?
Very close.
How is it that you looked so closely at her injuries?
I was in the same bed with her as she was. I was in the same bed with her.
All right. Did her injuries appear fresh?
Yes.
I'd like you to tell the jury her demeanor when you saw her that day.
She was weeping. She was in more pain than she could imagine.
All right.
She
could... Just what you saw.
She was weeping.
Weeping. All right. Did she appear to be upset?
Yes.
On January 23rd, after John had bonded out from jail, she said she saw him on their property. She heard his voice and looked out of her window. He was in the backyard and was speaking in a low tone. She couldn't hear what he was saying. After she saw him, she walked over to Jason's house. She wanted to let Tracy know that John was back on the property. Tracy wasn't there, so she walked back home. When she got home, she said the windows in John and Tracy's house were open, and she could hear them speaking in their living room. The next day, on January 24th, the day of the murders, she said she received several phone calls and text messages from John, from 4:17 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. At 4:24 p.m., he texted her and asked if there were any cops on their property. He told her that he didn't want to go back to jail. He said he was at a bowling alley and that there was a cop there who he felt was watching him. Ashley told him to just come home, that there were no cops there. She said during her phone calls with John in that time frame, he told her he was looking for Tracy. She testified that she eventually told him that Tracy was at Jason's house. Detective Eric Whedon analyzed John's phone records. He testified that after John was released from jail on January 22nd and told not to contact Tracy or Jason, he called Tracy a total of 53 times, with 7:34 p.m. on January 24th being the last time. John last used his phone to call Tracy at 7:34 p.m. that night, and then the next call he made was at 8:03 p.m. to his friend, Rhonda Porter. Detective Whedon then read out loud some transcripts of voicemails that were left on Tracy's phone. On January 24th at 4:15 p.m., John leaves a message saying that he's at a bowling alley and that there's a cop there watching him. He tells her that he doesn't know what time he can get there, but that he will get there and that he loves her. At 4:39 p.m., there's a message from Jason. He says, "Honey, give me a call if you would, please. Thank you." At 5:04 p.m., John leaves another message. "Baby, I'm home. Hurry up and get here, please. Get here, I'm home. I love you. Bye." At 5:13 p.m., John says, Trey, you need to call me back ASAP. It's an emergency. Call me back immediately. At 5:34 p.m., hey, baby, it's me. Call me back as soon as possible, okay? I need to talk to you. Call me ASAP. I love you. Bye. At 5:35 p.m., baby, please tell me you didn't set me up. Come on, baby. We love each other. Come on. Please call me back. Please. I love you. Call me. Love you. Bye. At 5:50 p.m., baby, you need to answer my call. You need to talk to me. Communicate with me, okay? Communicate with me, baby. Let me know what's going on, okay? Please, I love you. Please. What's going on? Please tell me. I love you. At 6 p.m., hey, baby, it's me. I expect you to come home, sweetheart. I love you. It's okay. Everything's fine, you know? Everything's fine, sweetheart, okay? Me and Bobby want you to come home, okay? We love you, okay? Okay? Sweetheart, I love you, sweetheart, with all my heart. Please call me. Come home. I love you. Bye. At 6:08 p.m. Hi, this is, I know, my baby. Yeah, I know the routine. Speak at the beep. Okay. Call me back, okay? I love you, okay? Please call me. Detective Whedon said that at 7:34 p.m., John's location data from his phone shows that he was in the vicinity of the crime scene. Then at 8:03 p.m., when he calls Rhonda Porter, he is down near her house. A woman named Dorothy Stolte, who would turn out to be perhaps one of the state's biggest witnesses, testified that John was her sister's boyfriend about 20 years ago and that they have a child together. She said she met Tracy about 4 or 5 times. She said Tracy was engaged to John. In December 2010, she went to Lowe's hardware store and purchased a Christmas gift for John. It was a package with a small knife, a keychain, and a compass in it, like a multi-tool. She gave it to him in January. In the days leading up to the murder, she was with John and Tracy at her brother's house in their garage.
And when you saw them together, can you describe Tracy's appearance?
Tracy was sitting inside the garage of my brother's garage in the fetal position with her hair all askew and no makeup on, and she looked very frightened.
All right. Was it unusual for you to see Tracy? You said that you'd seen her.
Yes, it's very unusual for Tracy not to have been made up, because she was a very pretty little girl. And
so all of the other times you had seen her, she was fixed up and had her hair done?
Yes.
You said that, can you describe anything else about her demeanor other than what you've just described?
Just that she seemed afraid. She wouldn't talk.
Dorothy said she did not want to come in and testify today. She said she doesn't like to be involved in things like this, where she can only testify in bits and pieces. John's older brother, Michael Lee Jr., took the stand next. He testified that in the early morning hours on January 25th, 2011, he spoke with his brother several times. Afterwards, he called the Sarasota Sheriff's Office. He said on January 29th, he spoke with Sergeant Montalbano again.
And during that phone call on January 29th, what did you tell Sergeant Montalbano about your brother John Lee's statements?
I told him that John's statement was that when I asked John what about the charges before him, that he had pending against him, I said, what's going to happen now with that, now that these people are deceased? And his statement was, well, I guess they're not going to testify against me. That's what he said.
He said Sergeant Montalbano came out to Oregon to meet with him in February and that he gave a formal statement then. On cross-examination, Michael said he has epilepsy and that he sometimes has seizures and experiences memory problems. Deputy Michael Gorn testified about the clothing found in the hole in the backyard at Rhonda's house. He said there were several areas of apparent blood staining on the shoes, and that the clothing matched what John was wearing on the surveillance footage from the courthouse that day. Deputy Gorn also testified about the bloody footwear impressions that had been found at the crime scene. He said there were similarities in the outsole design and physical size of the impressions, as well as with John's shoes. His conclusion was that John's shoes could have made the crime scene impressions. He was unable to eliminate them as the source. The next witness called to the stand was Rhonda Porter. She told the jury that she met John Lee when she was 16. They used to date in 1998 and dated for about 6 or 7 months. She recalled for the jury a conversation she had with John a couple days before the murder. She and her friend Jessica were at a park, having a beer and feeding the seagulls. While they were sitting in Rhonda's car, she called John. She said he told her about how he had just gotten out of jail for beating up his girlfriend. On the evening of January 24th, at about 8 p.m., she said she got a call from John. He asked her if he could come over, and she said, yeah, sure. He arrived about 15 to 20 minutes later and came right into her bedroom where she was laying in bed.
What did John Lee say to you after he came into your bedroom?
He said, I think I killed her.
And how did you respond to that?
Well, what, did you hit her too hard or something? Let's go check her pulse.
Okay. And what's the very next thing that he said to you?
No, I think I killed two people. No, I killed two people.
Did you notice anything unusual about him when he was in your bedroom?
He smelled the blood, death.
Did you ever smell blood before?
Yes.
And did you recognize the odor of blood?
Yes.
That odor of blood that John Lee had, was it a strong odor of blood, Ms. Porter?
Yes.
Prosecutor Mary Catherine Frevelig asked Rhonda if she drinks a lot of alcohol, and she said yes, that she drinks an 18-pack and a half bottle of vodka every day. She was drinking like that back then, too. As a result, Rhonda admitted that she sometimes has trouble remembering things. She told the jury that she and John went to her backyard that night at one point. They went into her garage and got a shovel. She carried his clothes while John carried the shovel and his shoes.
Once you got out there with John Lee, what's the very next thing that happened?
We looked for a spot that the neighbors couldn't see us digging.
In your backyard?
Yes.
And did you find a spot that was suitable, or did he find a spot that was suitable?
He did.
What's the very next thing that John Lee did after he found a spot?
Dug a hole.
Did you stand there and watch him dig that hole?
Yes.
And what were you doing while he was digging the hole?
Freaking out. I'm freaking out.
Were you holding the clothes?
Yes.
After he dug the hole, what's the very next thing that happened?
Put the clothes in it.
Right. Do you remember the clothing items that were put in the hole? If you don't remember,
that's jeans
okay.
And a shirt.
Right. And do you remember anything else?
Remember him being adamant about the shoes, how he didn't want me to touch the shoes. He was possessive about the shoes.
After they buried the clothes, she said they went to the garage to put the shovel back. They then went inside the house. She said John insisted on watching her as she went to the bathroom. He told her that he didn't want to turn his back to her because he was afraid that she would hit him over the head with the shower rod. They then went into her bedroom and laid down in bed. She said he held her down. She was on her side and he was behind her with his arm around her. It was there that he told her that he had thrown the murder weapon in the sewer as he was on his way to her house. She said she and John laid in bed the entire night. The following morning, her mom picked her up because she was scheduled to have surgery. John was still at her house when she left. She came home later that day. She said she drank a couple Smirnoff ice bottles and 2 4-packs while on her way home. When she got back to her house, the police were there. When she first spoke with them, she did not tell them that John had confessed to her. She didn't tell them about the clothing or the murder weapon either. She was asked why she didn't tell them. She said she was scared, that she was afraid of John Lee. And she also said that he threatened that he would frame her for the murders. The next time she spoke with police, she brought an attorney with her. She said she got an attorney because she was scared and figured it was the right thing to do. She then gave a formal statement at the police department with her attorney, which is when she told them about the clothes. In her third statement to police, also with her attorney, she told them that she remembered that he had told her about the murder weapon in the storm drain. Rhonda then told the jury that on the day she had her surgery, the day after the murders, John told her to send him a text message to make it look like they had been together the night before, so he would have an alibi. Rhonda's friend Jessica testified next. She said that she was there when Rhonda talked to John on the phone a couple days prior to the murder. She said she and Rhonda were sitting in the car, talking to him on speakerphone, when Rhonda got out to go throw some garbage away. Jessica continued to talk to John. She was asked what he told her about having been arrested.
He said that he went to jail, was arrested, and bonded out, and that he had gone down the street from where he lived and punched Jason.
Right. Did John Lee make any statements to you about Jason Salter in addition to that?
Yes, he said that if he saw Tracy at his house again, at Jason's house again, that he would kill him.
Wilson Broussard, the deputy chief medical examiner, described what he saw when he first arrived at Jason's house on January 24th. He described Tracy's body.
Can you tell the members of the jury what observations you made with respect to her injuries on the scene?
Yeah, you know, once getting close enough to her, you know, I could see that there were sharp force injuries, which is my terminology for, you know, cut and or stabbed, either one, but some kind of a sharp instrument causing a large wound on the left. There was something on the left upper chest area, and there was also another wound that was obvious on the right side of the neck.
He could tell by the blood on the couch that Tracy had sustained the injuries near where she lay. He said she didn't move from that area much at all. He then went into the bedroom and described what he saw when he came across Jason's body.
Yeah, initially, you know, he, Mr. Salter, is face down, and there was lots of blood on the floor. Some areas of blood were smeared, you know, from the backside, I think I could only really appreciate possibly one area on the shoulder. But we kind of lifted him just a little to see underneath, and we could see neck. There were neck wounds. There were areas on the chest and anterior throat that were cut.
Okay. Did you actually turn him all the way over at the scene?
No, just partially over just to see.
Broussard testified that at 1:40 a.m., Tracy was cool to the touch by her underarm area. Rigor mortis, the stiffening of the body after death, was starting to set in. He was asked if she could have been killed sometime between 7:34 p.m. and 8 p.m., and he said yes. Broussard then detailed Tracy's injuries. He said that on the left side of her neck was a slash wound that penetrated into the neck muscle and cut completely through the external jugular vein. It also cut completely through the carotid artery, the major artery of the neck. This was a fatal injury, he said. He observed two slash injuries and stab wounds on her neck, and then there were a couple of sharp force injuries on her left hand, consistent with her having tried to defend herself. He estimated that it would have taken her about 30 seconds maximum to lose consciousness. When asked if he could determine the location of Tracy's killer, he said it seemed like the killer was in front of her, and that she would have been aware who her killer was. He said Tracy died due to bleeding externally and internally as a result of the sharp force injuries to her neck and chest. Broussard also performed Jason's autopsy. He said Jason had two major fatal injuries on the left side of the neck that cut the carotid artery and a wound on the upper half of his chest that penetrated into his heart. Jason also suffered other injuries. In total, there were 14 stab wounds. Jason's cause of death was extensive bleeding into the chest and externally, combined with sharp force stab wounds to the neck and chest. When asked about the murder weapon, Broussard said that it would have been a single-edged knife, not serrated. He testified that several weeks after the homicide, he was shown a brand new knife package that a detective had purchased at Lowe's. He said this could have been the single weapon that caused each and every injury to Tracy and Jason. There was nothing to suggest that the injuries were done by more than one knife. Tiffany Roy, a DNA analyst, testified about the clothing collected from the hole in Rhonda's backyard. She said that the DNA from the blue t-shirt was a mixture. The major DNA profile matched Jason Salter, and John Lee could not be excluded from the minor profile. As for the shoes, the major profile matched Jason, and the minor profile was unknown. The socks contained a possible bloodstain that matched the DNA profile of John Lee. Roy testified that she also tested items from the crime scene. There was blood that was found on the cold water tap at the kitchen sink, and that matched Tracy. Blood swabs from the interior of the refrigerator was a mixture of three people, in which neither victim nor John Lee could be excluded. Roy testified that she did not find any DNA samples on the handle of the knife that had been found in the sewer. She told the jury that there could be a number of reasons for this. The fact that it was in a sewer drain for a month, for example, could impact the DNA results. On the blade, there was a partial DNA profile, but it was inconclusive. On cross-examination, Roy testified that Tracy had been excluded as being a part of the DNA mixture on the blue t-shirt and that her DNA was not on the blue jeans, socks, nor the shoes either. Regarding the jeans, she said there was a blood stain that was a mixture of two contributors. John Lee could not be excluded, but Jason and Tracy were excluded. John's attorney, Carolyn Schlemmer, asked, "So if it wasn't Jason or Tracy, it's a mixture of two people. It may be John Lee, and then we have an unknown?" Roy said yes. She said she was not given any other sample, so she doesn't know who it would be. The same was true for the shoes. The major profile matched Jason, but the minor excluded Tracy and John Lee. "Again, we have an unknown?" Schlemmer asked. Roy responded, "Yes, that's correct." Roy also said that the unknown partial profile on the blade of the knife was inconclusive, but that it excluded Tracy, Jason, and John Lee. After the DNA evidence, the state then rested their case. And we'll get into the defense's case right after this quick break from today's sponsors. The winter blues are coming to an end, finally, which means it's finally time to get back into a routine that empowers you to feel your healthiest with Care of. It can be really hard to know what vitamins or supplements you should be taking, but Care of makes it easy to find out what you specifically need to be your healthiest with their fun online quiz. Simply answer a few questions about your diet, your health goals, and your lifestyle choices, and then get your personal, scientifically backed vitamin and supplement recommendations in just 5 minutes. There are even vegan and vegetarian supplement options available to match your dietary needs. I've been using Care of for quite a while now. I started just after my pregnancy. I had no idea what sort of vitamins I should be taking, and so I went and filled out their online quiz, which was actually pretty fun. And then a couple days later, my necessary vitamins showed up on my doorstep. The individualized daily packets are so convenient, especially if you're someone who's always on the go. For 50% off, that's 50% off, your first month of personalized Care of vitamins, go to takecareof.com and enter junkie50. That's takecareof.com and enter junkie50 for 50% off your first month of personalized Care of vitamins. Love is patient, love is kind, but sometimes love can be deadly. As many of you listeners know all too well from listening to true crime podcasts, many couples may look happy, but we don't always know what happens behind closed doors. Every week, the Parcast Network's new podcast, Crimes of Passion, looks into what happens when true love meets true crime. Crimes of Passion analyzes the relationship dynamics and psychology that lead to betrayal, crimes, and even murder. New episodes of Crimes of Passion come out every Wednesday. You can listen to the first episode on Wilma Hoyt right now, and look for upcoming episodes on Amy Fisher and Joey Buttafuoco, Lorena Bobbitt, and Jodi Arias. Search for and subscribe to Crimes of Passion wherever you listen to podcasts. Again, search Crimes of Passion or visit parcast.com/passion to listen now. The defense's first witness was John Lee. He testified that he was working for a concrete company at the time of his arrest and that he has two kids, a 26-year-old son and a 20-year-old daughter. He said he met Tracy in July of 2010. He knew her for about 6 or 7 months before she died. He said she was his fiance. In January 2011, he and Tracy were living together at a residence on Park Road. He said the house was in a bad neighborhood. He was asked by his attorney, Carolyn Schlemmer, if Tracy had any medical conditions, and he said yes, that she was diabetic, had seizures, and was struggling with a known drug problem. He said she was using opiates and drinking a lot of alcohol. "Were you trying to get Tracy off of those drugs?" Schlemmer asked. "Yes, I most certainly was," he replied. He said he met Jason Salter once in December 2010. He knew Jason lived at the end of the street in what he called a known party house. He said Jason was giving Tracy drugs. Schlemmer asked what the significance of January 10th was, and John appeared to start crying on the stand as he said it was Tracy's birthday. On January 11th, he said he and Tracy went to the hospital. He said they had had a birthday party for her at their house. When everyone left, Tracy was in the kitchen, on the step stool to get into a cabinet. All of a sudden, he heard a crash and then heard her crying. He went into the kitchen and she told him that she had fallen off the stool. She was intoxicated at the time. He said he took her to the hospital where she got an x-ray for her knee and they told her that it was a minor sprain. She left with a Velcro knee brace and some crutches. John then talked about the incident on January 19th. He said he worked all day, and when he got home, Tracy wasn't there. He pulled into the driveway and went into the house. Both the front door and the back door were wide open. The heater was on and the dog was running around loose, which he said was not normal. He called Tracy's cell phone and they spoke. He said she sounded like she was under the influence of something. He asked where she was, and she said she was at a birthday party with her friend Ellie, who lives right by Jason's house.
Now tell the jury, what did you tell Tracy on the phone that day?
I told Tracy, I said, get your ass home.
Why?
Because she sounded intoxicated and she sounded, that she shouldn't have been in that area, or I didn't know what area she was at the time. That I was a little disturbed that I come home from working all day long and she's not home and the house is wide open and the heater's going full blast and the dog's running loose. Her purse was sitting there on the counter and everything, which was unusual.
It's unusual for her. Did you get in your truck and go anywhere at that point?
At that point, Tracy hung up on me, and I tried to call her back. She was not answering the phone. So I got in the dump truck, and I drove down to Ellie's house, thinking that she was at Ellie's. So when I get to Ellie's house, Ellie was not there. I looked across the street, which Ellie lives close to Jason, and I saw that there were some people going in and out of Jason's house.
He said he eventually found her at Jason's house. They were having what appeared to be a party. When asked how many people were present, he said he would estimate about 7 to 9 people.
Were you concerned that Tracy was at Mr. Salter's residence?
Yes, I was, very much so.
Why?
Because it was a... It was a known drug house, and I was concerned from what I had heard that Jason was supplying Tracy with her drug problem.
Objection, hearsay.
He said he knocked on Jason's front door and then looked in the window. He saw who he thought was Tracy running into the back bedroom, so he went to that window, looked inside, and saw her sitting on a bed.
I immediately went over there, and I knocked on the window, I said, get your ass out of that house now.
Are you banging on Mr. Salter's bedroom window?
Yes, I was.
Okay. Who was Tracy in that bedroom with?
I believe it was Ashley at the time.
Did you see Mr. Salter at this time at all?
No, I did not.
So you banged on the window, and at some point, does somebody come out of the residence?
Yes, they did.
Who comes out of the residence?
After I banged on the window, I walked around towards the side of the house, and Daphne Smith met me at the end of the concrete slab out there.
And did you have a conversation with Daphne Smith outside of Jason Salter's home?
Yes, I did.
And were you upset because Tracy was there at Jason's?
Yes, I was. Excuse me. Yes, I was upset.
Okay. And why were you so upset?
I was upset for the fact that I know that Tracy has a drug problem, and I was doing my best to try and keep her off of drugs. I promised her mom and dad that I would help do that. And I felt I wasn't doing my job. I was trying to make a good life for her and myself with our house and everything. I was going to work every day, and I come home, and I guess I just expected her to be there and maybe have dinner ready, or, you know, at least be happy to see me when I got home from work and everything. So I was kind of upset because I thought somebody was, you know, enabling her drug habit and her alcohol.
Objection, hearsay.
It was around 6 p.m. at this point, and after a few minutes, Tracy then came out of the house.
Tracy came out of the house and she ran up to me, "Hey, baby," and she put her arms around me, and I saw right then that she was under the influence of something. I knew it was alcohol. I said, "What have you been doing?" She said, "I'm drinking vodka and this and that. We're just partying. Come on in." I said, "No, I don't want to come on in."
Objection, hearsay.
Can you
fire
the evidence?
Overruled. Go ahead.
Thank you. So Tracy appeared to you to be intoxicated?
Yes, she did. Very much so.
Okay. All right. And who do you leave with then? Mr. Salter's home.
Tracy and I left together in the dump truck because I remember I had to help her into the truck.
Was that because of her state of intoxication?
That is correct.
Okay.
From there, he and Tracy went back to their house. They walked in, talked for a brief minute, and then John told her that he was going to unload the dump truck. He thought the day was over and that she was home and fine. After he dumped the sod and dirt out of the dump truck, he decided to drive over to Tracy's friend Ellie's house to have a talk with her and to see what was really going on. He said he wanted to see if she would help him by keeping Tracy away from Jason's house. He and Ellie talked for about 5 minutes. After he left there, he then went over to Jason's house. He said twice, over sustained hearsay objections, that Ellie had told him that Jason was supplying drugs to Tracy. He got to Jason's house and the side door was open. Jason was in the kitchen, putting something in the refrigerator. He said he approached him and asked if they could talk.
I said, "Can I talk to you?" And he said, "What do you want?" And I stepped into the house and I grabbed the refrigerator door and I was sitting there. I said, "Listen," I said, "I could appreciate it if you would not have Tracy down here. She has a drug problem and an alcohol problem and I'm trying to keep her off of these things. So please do not have her down here at your house anymore."
Did you say it like you just told the jury, "Please, Mr. Salter"? Well, or were you upset?
I was upset. I mean, I don't think I was, you know, the way I'm voicing it now. I don't think anybody would be, but I was more concerned. I just wanted to get my point across to him. Please do not enable her drug problem.
Did you ever hit Mr. Salter at that point?
No, I did not.
He told the court that Jason started to get aggressive with him.
When you were speaking with Mr. Salter, was there a point where he was walking towards you?
Yes, there was. He started towards me as I was, after I told him to not have nothing to do with Tracy and keep her out of his house, I started to back out of the house and he started coming at me like in an aggressive manner. And I told him, I said, "Just stop. I said, leave it alone. Just keep her away from your house."
He said that was the end of their encounter. Afterwards, he went back home. He said Tracy was gone at this point, and it was there that he was arrested for battering both Tracy and Jason, something he denied doing.
Did Did you ever grab Tracy Nabrigal and put your hand on her throat on January 19th?
I most certainly did not.
And were you arrested for battery?
Yes, I was.
Okay.
After John was arrested, he was in jail for a few days. He was released on January 22nd after being bonded out by his friend Steve. He said the judge told him not to have any contact with Tracy or Jason. He was asked why he then violated those conditions of his release, why he went to Jason Salter's house on the night of the 24th, and he said it was because he was concerned about Tracy's well-being, because of the drugs, and because of her medical condition.
Did you, in fact, call, text, and see Tracy Nabrigal between January 22nd and January 24th?
Yes, I did.
You knew, did you know you were not supposed to be doing those things?
Yes, I did.
And during that time frame, was Tracy also, like, calling you?
Yes, she was calling me.
On January 23rd, the day after he was released, he and Tracy went to Venice Beach. He was asked if Tracy told him that Jason had been supplying her with drugs, and the prosecution objected again, citing hearsay. The judge sustained the objection and asked the jury to disregard the question. He was asked if he had any knowledge that Tracy and Jason were romantically involved, and he lifted up his hands and said, "Common sense," which was then objected to as speculation from the prosecutor. It was sustained, and John seemed to be aggravated and shook his head. John then went over the day of the murders, January 24th. He said by this time he had lost his job because his boss doesn't tolerate any of his employees being arrested. He told the jury that throughout the day, he was with his friend Steve and with Tracy. At approximately 3 p.m., he went to the South County Courthouse to meet with Nancy Williams. He filled out the motion to modify the terms of his release so he could legally go back to his house. When asked why he didn't note anything about drug usage on that paperwork, he said he didn't want to make Tracy look bad. Later that day, he text messaged Ashley from the bowling alley. He said he had seen a police cruiser in the bowling alley parking lot. He knew he was not supposed to be at the house, and so he didn't want to risk it. When he got home, Tracy was not there. He said he knew her phone was dead and knew that she didn't have her phone charger with her. He noticed her purse was on the kitchen counter and the dog was there. He said he tried calling and calling Tracy's phone. He then went over to Jason's house. He said that while he was in jail, Tracy had moved her stuff there, and so he figured she left something there and went to get it.
What did you see when you went to Mr. Salter's home?
The music was playing real loud. I could hear it from the street. I approached the house and I heard some screaming and hollering. I was looking at the window and I seen what appeared to be some arms flying around, some people moving quickly. I went to the side door. Side door was open a little bit. As I walked in the door, I saw Jason Salter standing over top of Tracy on the couch, throwing his hands at her in the process of killing her.
Schlummer paused while John put his head in his hands and rubbed his eyes, as though he was sobbing.
Could you determine whether the screaming was a male or a female voice?
The music was playing loud. It appeared to be both.
At this point, Mr. Lee, is it dark outside?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
He said he went to the side door and went inside.
After you went inside of that door, tell us what you saw.
I saw Jason standing over top of Tracy, swinging his hands at her, killing her.
Could you tell at that point if anything was in his hands, and if so, what was it?
When I walked in there, I ran towards him and hollered at him. He turned around and had what appeared to be a weapon in his hand and started screaming at me, "I'm going to kill you," and came after me.
He then described his encounter with Jason.
Tell the jury then, after Mr. Salter threatens you, what does he do next?
He came after me, and we started fighting, and I just I don't know how it happened so quick. I was trying to get him off me. He just kept coming after me. He seemed like he was in a rage, under the influence or something or whatever. He was just screaming, hollering at me, and I just saw Tracy, him, what he just did to her. And so I was just in a fight for my own life at that time.
Do you have any idea approximately how long you were struggling with Mr. Salter?
At this point, I still to this day, I can't recall. It just, everything happened so fast. I was just trying to get the man off of me. He just kept advancing towards me. I'm just trying to push him away from me at this time.
Let's talk about that a little bit more now. You indicated a little bit ago that he had a weapon. At what point, if you are able to determine that it's a knife or a gun, what is it?
It was a knife.
And at some point, are you able to disarm him from that knife?
Yes, I was.
Do you know at what point you were able to disarm him? Had you struggled first and you were able to get it away? Or describe to the jury what happened?
It just happened so fast. I'm still to this day, I'm just so, I just cannot put it back. I sit there and lay and think about it every day, every moment. What happened?
He doesn't know how many times Jason advanced towards him, but said it was continuous.
After you disarm him, and you now have the knife, what happens?
Jason kept coming after me, and I kept trying to push him away, get him off of me.
Do you stab him?
Yes, I did.
And where does the stabbing start? Like, in what room in the house?
At that time, I was unsure where I was, but apparently it happened towards the stereo area.
Speculation.
Overruled.
Yes, you did.
It just happened so fast. I mean, how do you explain it?
Do you remember the struggle and you stabbing Mr. Salter starting in the living room area?
Yes,
do
I
you?
Did.
Okay, all right.
The struggle then moved into the bedroom. He said he was being pushed by Jason. He was asked how he was able to get control of the knife.
Do you remember, well, first of all, are you right or left-handed?
I'm left-handed.
Okay. Do you remember which hand you used to, did you grab the knife with your left hand?
When he came at me with the hand, I grabbed his arm with both of my hands.
Show me that again. Describe that.
When he came at me, I grabbed with both.
You grabbed what?
I grabbed his arm. When he was coming at me with his arm, I remember his arm being bent. I want to say that one of the knife wounds was inflicted when I bent his arm into him, and that's when I was able to obtain the weapon from him.
He said everything happened so fast. He continued to struggle and to stab Jason in the bedroom. He said he was trying to get away from him, but Jason kept coming after him.
Do you recall at what point his neck was cut?
No, I do not.
Was his neck cut, if you recall, in the bedroom?
I really couldn't tell you where it was cut or whatever, or where any part of him was cut.
Okay. Why does Jason Salter, according to Dr. Broussard, have so many stab wounds?
Because he kept advancing towards me, kept coming after me, and I'm trying to get away from him. I'm trying to push him off of me.
He was asked to tell the jury how it ended. He said it ended when Mr. Salter fell to the floor.
When Jason fell to the floor, I turned around to get away, and I went out to check on Tracy.
Did you touch Tracy?
I walked up to her and put my hand on her. Yes, I did.
Do you know if you got any blood on your hand at that point?
I'm sure that I did. I didn't. I was in numb and shock. I didn't know. I didn't know what I was doing at that time. I was just scared. I went over and checked her. And when I saw the neck wound, I knew that she was dead.
He was asked if there was any point in which he went to the refrigerator, and he said yes.
I walked into the kitchen after I had touched Tracy. Refrigerator door was partially open. I remember just pushing it or something to that effect, and I walked to the sink.
What did you do at the sink?
I turned on the water and washed my hands.
And at this point, are you in shock?
I'm devastated. I didn't know what to do.
As for why he didn't call the police, John started crying and said he's a convicted felon with 14 felonies in his past, and he didn't think that anybody would believe him. Afterwards, he went back to his house. He said he thinks he walked around for a second, and then he called Rhonda Porter. They had spoken on the phone earlier that day, and so he thought of her. He then went to Rhonda's home. He said he doesn't know how he got there. He drove his van, but he has no idea what route he took. He was in such shock, he said. When he got to Rhonda's house, her disabled husband and son were home. Rhonda was intoxicated when he arrived. She offered him a beer, and he drank it.
When I went into the house, I went into Rhonda's room, and Rhonda said, asked me.
Don't tell us what Rhonda told you. What did you do? What did you do?
I went in there and told Rhonda that two people were dead. I think I killed him.
Okay, now repeat that.
I said, two people are dead. I think I killed him.
Two people are dead. You're saying, I think I killed him.
That is correct.
Okay. Not, I think I killed them.
No, I did not say them. I said him.
Okay.
He and Rhonda then buried his clothes.
Tell the jury, Mr. Lee, why are you burying your clothes?
I didn't know what to do. I was scared. I didn't know what to do. Rhonda said.
Objection, hearsay.
Say.
Tell us what Rhonda said. Why are you burying the clothing?
I was scared. I didn't know what to do. I was in a state of shock. I just was numb. I didn't know what to do about anything.
Schlemmer then asked him what happened to the knife, and he said he couldn't be sure what happened to it.
Do you have any memory of throwing the knife in the sewer or doing anything with it?
I have no memory of doing anything with it.
Schlemmer asked about the knife that was presented into evidence by the prosecution. She asked if he remembered Dorothy Stolte buying him that knife, and he said he doesn't remember, but it's possible. She asked if he ever carried it on him, and he said he never carried any weapons on him at any time. She then asked him if he had any personal knowledge that Jason was staying at his house while he was in jail, and he said yes, he did. John told the jury that he stayed the night at Rhonda's house. Her husband and son were there too. The next morning, Rhonda left him there while she went to go have her surgery. And later that day, he was arrested at Rhonda's house.
Tell the jury, Mr. Lee, did you kill Tracy Nabergall?
I most certainly did not.
Who killed Tracy Nabergall?
Jason Salter.
Tell the jury, did you stab Mr. Salter?
Yes, I did.
Why did you stab him?
Because he was advancing toward me and I was acting in self-defense.
On cross-examination, prosecutor Mary Catherine Fravelig went right into the battery charge he was arrested for on January 19th.
Now, Mr. Lee, you told the jury this morning that on January 19th, you got home from work and that you had worked all that day. Isn't that right?
That is correct.
And that when you got home, Tracy wasn't there to make your dinner, was she?
She was not home, no.
But you did tell the jury that one of your concerns was she wasn't there to make your dinner, right?
It wasn't.
Did you say it?
It wasn't a dinner issue.
You left her at home and she stepped out, didn't she? And the dog was running around unattended?
Yes, he was.
And Tracy left all the doors open?
Yes, she did.
And Tracy had the nerve to leave the house without your permission, didn't she?
That was not the case. She never had to ask me for permission to leave the house.
And the fact is that when you got home and you found that you had no dinner, the dog was running around, Tracy wasn't there, you got angry, didn't you?
That is not true.
You were furious with Tracy for not being where she was supposed to be.
No, that is not correct.
Fravelig brought up Daphne Smith's testimony, where she testified that John was angry when he came over to Jason's house on January 19th and that he was banging on the doors looking for Tracy. She asked him about his arrest that night.
So Jason Salter hit you, and then the police arrested you, right?
Jason Salter did not hit me.
And the police arrested you?
I was arrested that night, yes.
And you were furious because Tracy told the cops that you hit her, weren't you?
I was not happy for being lied upon, no.
You weren't happy or you were furious?
I wasn't furious. I wasn't happy that I was being lied upon.
In fact, what you told Rhonda was, that bitch put me in jail, didn't you?
I did not tell Rhonda that statement.
Now, you thought it was perfectly okay to go up to somebody else's house and bang on the windows and doors? You think that was okay?
I would ask that Mr. Lee be able to answer this question without interruption.
That's the question, if you thought it was okay.
I was concerned for Tracy. That was the reason why I did what I did.
Did you think it was okay to go up onto someone else's property uninvited?
There was a birthday party going on. There was a lot of people there, and I knew Tracy was there, and I knew what kind of house it was. So I was concerned for her.
All right. Do you have anything else to tell me before you answer my question? Do you think it's okay to go up onto someone else's property uninvited?
I don't understand
the question. It's a question. Simple question.
I don't understand, you know, uninvited. I mean, people go up, walk to people's doors all the time without being invited on their property.
So do you think it's okay to go up and bang on someone's window and look into their home without permission? Do you think that's okay?
I first said that I knocked on the door first and did not get no response from the door. That is, I didn't go directly to the window. I went to the door. And then I noticed, I believe what I saw was Tracy running to another room. So that is the reason why I went to the bedroom and knocked on the window.
All right. Is there anything else you want to explain before you answer my question?
Judge,
move on.
She then asked him about the abuse allegations.
You wanted to make a nice home for her, but you were hitting her in that home, weren't you?
No, I was not hitting her.
You were grabbing her by her throat.
No, I was not.
Slamming her up against the wall.
That is not true.
Hurt her leg, so she had to wear a brace and a crutch.
That was not my testimony, no.
A home where she was controlled by, in every single facet of her life, by you.
That's not true. I'm at work all day. How can she be controlled by me?
You told this jury that you were upset when you got home and Tracy wasn't there to make your dinner. But the fact of the matter is, you were enraged, weren't you?
No, I was not.
You were furious,
Judge,
weren't you?
Ask Mr. Lee be able to finish the question without being interrupted.
Go ahead, answer it.
No, I was not furious.
You were infuriated, weren't you?
I was not infuriated.
Okay, that's an answer. Let's move on.
Fravelig reiterated that he was not supposed to have any contact with Tracy or Jason. But you did, didn't you? She asked. Yes, I did, he said.
You called Tracy 53 times in direct violation of a no-contact order, didn't you?
Can I explain the 53 times?
Answer my question.
Yes, I did.
And every time you called Tracy and she didn't pick up the phone, you got angrier and angrier, didn't you?
Her phone was not charged, and I was just trying to get through to her.
Is there anything else that you want to tell me before you answer my question?
Judge, I'm going to...
Don't ask them.
Fravelig then went into John's alleged struggle with Jason. She asked where his defensive wounds were, if he was being attacked.
If you were being attacked, where's your defensive wounds?
I was the one that was able to get the weapon away from Jason.
So you were able to get the weapon away from Jason and stab him once?
Everything happened so fast. I was trying to get away from him, but he kept advancing towards me like a madman.
Like a madman?
Yes, ma'am.
And you had the knife in your hand when he was advancing towards you like a madman?
That is correct.
So you were able to stab him twice?
If, however many times.
Three times? Four times? Yes?
Whatever.
Five times?
Whatever.
Is that right?
Officer Sarr testified to.
Six times? Isn't that right?
Whatever the testimony is.
Seven times? Isn't that right?
He's answered.
Sustained.
You stabbed Jason Salter 14 times, didn't you? And that's your defensive wound right there. If you actually got it that day.
Displayed on the screen was a photo of John's hand that was taken after his arrest. There's a small cut on his left hand. Frevelig then asked about Jessica's testimony, in which she said he told her that if he found Tracy over at Jason's house again, he would kill him. John denied ever saying that to her. Frevelig displayed a photo of Jason deceased, lying on the floor in a pool of blood.
Now, are you telling this jury that that's the man that kept advancing towards you and backed you into the bedroom?
Yes, I am.
So that man, lying there on the floor in a pool of blood, is the man that attacked you?
Judge, ask an answer.
Overruled.
Turn around and look at the picture.
I don't want to look at the picture.
Is that the man that attacked you and backed you into the bedroom with a knife?
Yes, it is.
Frevelig then asked how Jason would have the knife that Dorothy Stolte had purchased for John.
Let me just go back to that knife. You said it was possibly the same knife. So you're telling this jury that Jason Salter had the knife that Dorothy Stolte bought for you, and that's the same knife that was in the storm drain? Is that what you're telling us?
Can I explain that?
Just answer my question. Are you telling us that that's the same knife?
Judge, I'd ask Mr. Lee be able to answer the question.
Do you want to redirect?
It's possible, yes.
Oh, it's possible that Jason Salter had the same knife that Dorothy gave you and the knife that you threw in the storm drain.
That is correct.
You didn't suffer any injuries whatsoever when Jason Salter attacked you with that knife, did you?
Apparently not.
Steve Stolte, one of John Lee's friends and Dorothy Stolte's brother, also testified for the defense. He said he's known John for about 20 years and met Tracy through John. He told the court that he owned the house where John and Tracy lived. He said he wanted John to live there in order to watch the property. The neighborhood had a very bad reputation for drug use and vandalism, which was a concern for property values. He testified that he never saw any injuries on Tracy and said John was very happy with her. While John was in jail, he said he saw Jason on the property. He told him to leave and also told Tracy to leave. The defense also recalled Detective Eric Whedon to the stand. He was asked to read a text message that had been sent to Tracy's phone. It was from Jason from January 23rd, 2011. It read, "You are back with John. You need to get your stuff now." The defense then tried introducing three witnesses who were ready to testify that Jason Salter had a reputation in their community for being violent. But after hearing their testimony without the jury present, the judge ruled that they would not be allowed to testify. So the defense rested their case. The jury found John guilty of the murders of Tracy and Jason, and after deliberating for just an hour, they decided to recommend the death penalty. After the trial, John's defense team filed a 236-page motion for a new trial, which delayed John's official sentencing by the judge. They wrote that the state's main witness, Dorothy Stolte, who had testified about purchasing that multi-tool kit with the knife inside for John for Christmas, had been coerced by the prosecutor. They said Dorothy had been jailed for 5 days during the trial and that she had been denied access to an attorney or to her family and was threatened with hard time if she didn't testify as the prosecutors wanted. In the response, Frevelig said that Dorothy hadn't shown up to two pre-trial depositions and that she had indicated that she would refuse to appear at trial, even after being subpoenaed. After a day-long hearing, the judge denied the defense's request for a new trial. But there was something else in their motion that required another hearing. The defense was also claiming that the prosecutors failed to turn over exculpatory evidence in the form of an email that Dorothy Stolte had sent to them prior to trial. In the email, Dorothy wrote that she knew that Tracy had been seeing Jason while John was in jail. John's defense team said that email could have substantiated their claims that the two were romantically involved. The prosecutor said they hadn't admitted it into evidence because they thought that it was inadmissible and hearsay. But Circuit Judge Peter Dubensky did not agree with them and wrote, quote, "With respect to their discovery obligation, prosecutors should not determine the consistency or inconsistency of statements made by material witnesses. Prosecutors do not rule on issues of admissibility of evidence, and they certainly do not limit disclosure by determining that it is rumor or hearsay. In a prosecution for first-degree murder where the death penalty is sought, disclosure must be the first and last obligation." And so he ordered that there would be yet another trial for John Lee. And in this new trial, not only would the email be admissible, but so would Jason's history of violence towards women, which could go towards a motive for Jason to have possibly wanted to kill Tracy, as John had claimed in his testimony. In April 2018, John's third trial began, and again, he was convicted of two counts of first-degree murder. The jury voted 9-3 for the death penalty, but in Florida, the jury must be unanimous in sending someone to death row, so John will instead be sentenced to life in prison. And that's all for today's episode. As always, I'd love to hear your thoughts on today's case. Do you think something else could have been done to protect John's victims after his initial arrest for battering them? After John expressed his urgency to contact Tracy again to the pretrial services supervisor, do you think the victims should have been warned? And finally, what did you make of John's testimony? You can contact me by tweeting me at CourtJunkiePod, emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com, or by finding me on Instagram at CourtJunkie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.